Hello and welcome to Louder Than Words, the podcast that's all about ideas that improve lives. I'm Jules Pretty. In this episode, we're talking about our bodies and sense of self. This physical body we carry for life, how it changes and how our perceptions change, how it influences self-worth, and how understanding of the body differs across cultures and changes over time. I'm delighted to welcome two wise colleagues from the University of Essex, an art historian and a psychologist, to help us answer these kinds of questions. Welcome to Matt Lodder and to Helga Gilmeister. Matt and Helga, thanks so much. Let's start with this. You've both worked for many years on the body. We as individuals carry this body. We are embodied in networks of relationships with others. Does body image and sense of self affect our well-being?
Hi, Jules. Thank you for having me. Yes, absolutely. I mean, in psychology, we see the body as the foundation of our sense of self. And therefore, as you said, we're born in this body and there are things that we cannot change about it. But there are also things that we can change about it. And that's really interesting because some people take that as a way to, if you will, regulate and control themselves in their lives. So it can affect well-being in good ways and in bad ways.
Yeah, so as an art historian who's interested in kind of changing bodies, right, tattoos and body modification practices, I'm super interested in how, in that same way, is how people are constructing their sense of self or kind of mediating their sense of self through transformation. And actually, I'd say that our bodies don't just tell us about individuals, but they tell us about societies and cultures and moments and subcultures, right? Like our bodies are kind of indexes for the place and the time and the cultural context in which we find ourselves.
So that's very interesting. So the body is clearly an individual thing. Here we are, each with one, and yet we're contextualized within a culture, a society, or at a particular time and a place. Do we find it hard to accept our bodies as they are?
I think, you know, as a historian of this stuff, it seems like changing our bodies is basically as old as, you know, as human beings are. The basic sense seems to be that the first kind of tattooing goes back about 100,000 years. You know, it's about as old as making jewellery or maybe or carving things into stone. So there is this kind of, seems to be this quite basic desire to kind of muck around with the canvas, if you like, the kind of substance of our bodies. And we find body modification and tattooing and all kinds of other things that people do to themselves pretty much everywhere. And I think that speaks to something quite interesting about what it means to be a human being, right? Like the changing the body, I always want to say it's not a phenomenon, but it's a medium. It's a way of communicating something about ourselves and about the cultures we find ourselves in. I don't know if Helga agrees with this, but I never want to pathologize it and say there's a kind of problem with doing that. I think that seems to be quite a recent phenomenon, a recent thing. But from my point of view, yeah, like changing the body is just something really basic that human beings have always done and always will do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a way to express your identity, and it's a way to as I said, it's for self-regulation. So it's a way to express a changing identity, for example, which I think is something that's often done with body modifications, isn't it? But we sort of so far talked about the body as from the outside, and that's very much the body image. It's a sort of conscious mental representation of who we are from the outside. But of course, there are other sides to the body, like what we do with it, right? So the competencies that we have, the skills that we use, and some of those are just phenomenal, aren't they? The way that people use their bodies, and it inspires people. So it's not just how we look, it's also what we do. And I think these also play into cultural aspects as well. So
I think that's super interesting, because the standard kind of metaphors we use, and even I do, you know, slip into them, is this idea of a kind of inside out model. Mm. And actually, it's a kind of, you know, it's a feedback loop, right? Like how we think about our bodies and what we do with them affects then how we feel and how we think and how we connect with other people around the world. And as technologies change and as fashions and trends change, basically, and as philosophies about the body evolve and change over time, like we end up with this kind of interestingly productive feedback loop between the inside and the outside. And it doesn't really make any sense to talk about them in that straightforward way.
I agree. They're not separate. Of course, they feed into each other. And I was going to say, sorry, I should try to interrupt you there. It influences how worthy we feel as a person. So, you know, if you can do things with your body, then it sort of almost doesn't matter as much. So these things are in balance in a way. So, we talk about appearance and competence as two sides of something that you can do. And often in when we try and come up with ideas about how we can change, because you asked about dissatisfaction with the body earlier, didn't you? When we try and, that there are ways that you can take people's focus on their appearance away and move it more to competence. And often that you can see that in all realms of life. If people suddenly acquire a physical disability, for example, then often there's a real obsession with turning to sports, for example. Those are things that are really, I think, interesting. In the way that people balance those aspects of themselves and of their bodies.
Mm. So you've talked, Matt, about in the elsewhere about a number of perspectives as the body as the carrier of art. You've got the maker and the creator. You've got the carrier, the person, and then the observers. Yeah. So we've got a number of kind of lenses or views or gazes even on the body. Could we just kind of focus then for a moment on a contemporary problem situation, which might not be a problem for everybody, which is about overweight. So a contemporary issue in almost every industrialized so-called rich country of the world has been in recent years an expansion in the number of people who are carrying more weight than they would in previous generations. Mm-hmm. And we don't seem to know what to do about it in policy terms. You could say this is down to the food system, diet system, the drink industry and so forth. But the body is subject to ranges of disorders. I mean, how do we kind of talk about these things in a way that could open up a kind of a different sort of conversation about, and I've framed it in terms of overweight, but it might be under as well, of course. That's a kind of another set of issues there as well, isn't there?
Yeah, it's reasonably controversial because it's not clear whether overweight, to what extent overweight is a problem. I mean, obviously, there comes a time when it may be a problem, but it's easy to think of fatness as a bad thing, but fatness is not necessarily fitness. You know, they're perfectly fit people who are overweight. So we shouldn't kind of just look at appearance. We should look at other things. You know, are these people actually, is it a problem, right? And it is a problem the moment it leads to unhealthy ability. You know, it leads to a lack of an ability to move around, for example, or it leads to a cardiovascular problems, it leads to a higher incidence of cancer, and all of these things are true, but they're not necessarily true for any one person who's overweight, right? So it depends on how fit they are. So that's one thing, to kind of step away from that appearance. But yeah, so how do we tackle problems with food and eating is kind of what your question is. One of the things that
in a sense, like kind of where's the locus of control? Because some people would say in a hyper-individualized society and economy that we kind of have here, that it's all down to individual choice. Yeah. And therefore, if you appear to make the wrong choice, you're morally in some way at fault. But it might be nothing to do with that. You may take some, may be deliberate. I've spoken to former police officers who said, well, the first thing that I did when I joined was to put on more weight because I got pushed around too easily. Yeah. You know, in and prison officers in the same way, they put on weight in order to stop being pushed around. So you start to find, well, where's the control here, actually?
Well, I think this is something that comes out of the 19th century in lots of ways, right? And I'm particularly interested in sort of purposive directed modifications generally, like tattooing. But I think some of the same conversations we were just having about the relationship between body and self and world apply here too, right? Like the idea of the, in the 19th century was that there was something physiognomic that was manifested on your body about your character, whether that was racial or to do with disability or to do with criminality
or intelligence.
You could read, you know, could measure someone's skull, you could read on their body, you could even see their tattoos and see what a kind of person, what a terrible person they were. And I think that comes from an understanding of this inside out idea that you forget there's a kind of social conversation happening. And I think, you know, in terms of body image more generally, we forget that actually body image is a relation between the inside and the outside. And so I think there's been a problem in discourse, and certainly in a lot of psychological discourse, it seems to me, about the about those relationships. Because, for example, if we're talking about, you know, people feeling that their body image is pathologized, that they have to look a certain way because society mandates that, that's kind of understood only as an outside-in problem, you know. Whereas for me, as an art historian, I want to think about this as a relationship and go, well, I understand why people want to look certain ways in the visual cultures or the cultural context of a particular moment in time. That's kind of understandable in a kind of aesthetic sense without having to resort to pathologizing it as a failure. Now, how you mandate that is change the conversation about the relationships between images and selves. You don't do it by, yeah, as you said, Jules, kind of reducing it to an individual moral failing and saying you need to do better, or to a social failing, to say stop showing people pictures of underweight or, you know, or idealized bodies and the problem goes away, because we know that isn't the case. It's all what we're dealing with ourselves is a mediation, and our bodies are a reflection of that. You know, I think that's forgotten in so many of these debates when they're reduced to this simplistic one-way conversation, whichever way that is.
Yeah, so you talk, Helga, to students within psychology about kind of issues relating to the body. Mm-hmm. Are there things that people, as you were saying there, Matt, that in a kind of current generation are seeing the world in a different way because of the images that you can access and see? There's a presentation of all kinds of forms of individualized bodies, largely, in a way that wasn't the case 10 years ago or even 20 years ago. Has that kind of changed the way that people see things, or do we think that actually we're pretty kind of able to adapt and change? And
I mean, as Matt said, if you know, we know it isn't the case that the images in the media and all around are solely responsible for any of those issues, because then otherwise everybody would have those issues, yeah. Right, and that's just not the case. So, and it's only one small, it's a significant risk factor, but it's only one small risk factor among many, many risk factors for people developing these issues. And just to sort of hark back to the sense of the sense of identity, there's a need that people have for control in their lives, like you said, yeah. the person that you mentioned who put on weight when his life dictated in a way that he needed more control. And it's one way for people to gain control over themselves, and whether that goes in the direction of just eating lots because you can, or restricting your intake because you can, or exercising excessively because it changes, you know, the things around your body that, you know, perhaps you're unhappy with, or perhaps you just need that control. So it's one way that, and this is what we see in people with eating disorders, just across the board, regardless of the kind of eating disorder that they may be diagnosed with, is that there is a real search for an identity. And often this is where it becomes difficult to treat, because often people don't want to lose that sense of identity. If I'm not an anorexic, who am I? So these are really things about identity and about personal control, rather than about eating or about bodies even.
Yeah,
I think it's just a way you can control the world, right?
I found that super interesting over the years, because those conversations come up a lot. I mean, where my work and thinking has intersected with this has been particularly around plastic surgery, less around food, but more about this technologization of body transformation. And there's been a long conversation, I mean, really forever, but particularly from the 90s onwards, about the kind of scourge of plastic surgery, and how if we just kind of do away with images of beautiful people with idealized bodies, people will stop wanting to get plastic surgery. But actually, the focus on the technology of that does away with what the actual problem is, which is social conversations about individualization, about control, about status, you know. Because when I do a lecture about this for some of our students here, and I sort of give them examples of people that I know that use the exact same technologies but to do very interesting and non-homogenous things with their bodies. The problem is the kind of social space in which we can kind of be our bodies and have certain kind of bodies rather than the technologies. But so many of our conversations, whether it's around exercise, whether it's around plastic surgery, whether it's about food even, come down to this kind of individualization of the problem. And well, we ban the technology, or we kind of remove the impetus, and the problem goes away. And actually, it seems to me that we need to have better conversations about the relationships between self, body and world to enable people to explore and experience their bodies in ways that are more, you know, that are healthier, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, there are healthy and unhealthy ways to eat and eat a lot or not eat very much. There are healthy ways to transform your body, and there are unhealthy ways to do that. You know, the technologies aren't the problem.
It's really interesting that
you say that, because there's some ideas also with the starvation that we see, the extreme restriction with eating, that has connections to some spiritual practices. Like if you think about the medieval asceticism, that it's exactly that. And so it's thought, for example, for some of the behaviors that we see, like the binging and as well as the restricting, that goes back a long, long way. And there's a beautiful paper written, I can't remember when it came out, at some point not too long ago, 2012 or so, like taking a historical account of all of these eating disorder kind of practices to see to what extent they are actually culturally driven from modern times, because that's often the easy avenue to take.
We always want to say that.
Yes, exactly, that it's just, oh, it's Western society that does it and so on. But for some of those behaviours, I mean, for some that is true, but for some of those kinds of behaviours, it's not. It's got a long, long history in a way of connection to something else.
This is the utility, I think, of thinking about things historically, because a lot of writing about tattooing by non-historians is like, oh, what's all this crazy thing people are doing to themselves, and why would they do that? It must be something wrong with modern society. And people have been saying that for hundreds of years.
Or thousands of years.
And if you put it into this historical context, you get something much more complex about the relationship between the mind and the body and the world. And actually, as you said, and again, I think something that is often forgotten, doing, like, changing your body hurts often, but that comes with endorphins and it comes with a rush, and then negotiating your new body is also kind of interesting, psychologically speaking. And so that you know, it's no kind of surprise that we find this link between body and mind and spirituality and belief and even the kind of fears of those practices when they're encountered by people who don't understand them, all over the world, always. Mm. Yeah.
And through our lives, you know, through each of our own lives, not only historically in terms of cultures, but latitudinally, as it were, across cultures at a particular time, and then as we go through our own lives, what we feel in terms of these external social norms or pressures will be different at different stages.
This is what I find interesting about some of the discourse about tattooing, and I think probably about body image more generally, is it's quite disruptive to a sense of time and self, because, you know, one of the questions tattooed people get asked a lot is, what are you going to do when you're older, right?
Which is sort of, I'm just going to be old.
Well, yeah. Well, it's a paradox if you think about it, because the question encodes the idea that, you know, how silly you are for being fashionable right now. You know, the cliche is tattoos are a permanent reminder of a temporary idea. But then on the flip side, that question also encodes the question, how dare you not be fashionable in future? You know, how dare you not be a la mode in many years' time? And so, like, tattoos...
Can you be fashionable in your 90s?
Well, exactly.
What's wrong with that?
Well, the idea is that you'll have a tattoo that will be out of date, right? But so tattooing kind of disrupts or perhaps even makes visible our particular relationship to the vicissitudes of fashions and stuff, you know?
What's the answer that people give when they're asked?
Well, I think this is one of the things that tattooed people don't understand the question, really. Okay. But non-tattooed people are very worried about it. It reveals something about their own anxieties, I think. Mm.
It's often, isn't it, also like it marks significant events in people's lives as well, doesn't it? So in a way, why would you get rid of that? In a way, you know, why would you be worried about that not being there when you're old? You know, it's exactly, you want it to be there, like a good memory, as it were, or a memory of a just a significant event or a moment in your life.
I've been very, so there's a philosopher called Galen Strawson, who basically has this idea of like episodic selfhood, right? So the standard idea of ourselves is that we construct them through stories. We tell a story about our lives and they match up. And actually his idea is like, well, we need a different I live episodically. I'm a different person from kind of episode to episode. He's apparently quite difficult to work with because if you arrange a meeting with him, he doesn't turn up because he says that was the previous me.
That was the other me.
That arranged the meeting. But, you know, in tattooing, there's this idea that, you know, the tattoos are a diary or a narrative on the body. But again, that's too individualized. It forgets this idea that actually your body is written on by external forces too. You are not the author of your own body. Mm. Your body exists in a conversation.
Yeah. And going back to what we were saying about, I mean, that kind of conversation, if we think again about food, Helga, is that yes, you might be able to choose the food on your plate or in the dish that you have before you, but you might not be able to. And for other reasons. You might not have enough money, you might be in a particular kind of context. The food itself is being changed by other external forces that you may not have control about. And there was a famous saying written, I think it's kind of famous, by a certain prime minister of a country in Northwest Europe that we'll know well, where he said of people who are overweight, face it, it's your own fat fault. Mm. And I know this is a kind of play with language and it's kind of, you know, it's depressing in that sense. Mm. But that kind of pushing it back just to individuals who are not then given the kind of space in which to write the story that you've just mentioned about. And so I'm kind of interested in how we take that on. You mentioned the exercise, you might be kind of... you know, in your 60s and you suddenly take up running and there's a new thing, there's a new story in your life. So people have got these opportunities to create these different episodes, haven't they?
And the kind of messaging doesn't really, you know, we know that doesn't actually work. The kind of shaming people for those things doesn't actually, it has the opposite effect to the effect that it's intended. And we know this from research. So, yeah, no, but it's great if people reinvent themselves and kind of, you know, try out different versions of themselves in response to, you know, just events in their lives. I think that's that can be really healing. Actually.
Well, there might be just some basic arithmetic, which is that people are living longer. So, you know, if we went back to kind of 1600s Japan, the period of the beginning of the Edo period, flowering of poetry and pilgrimages and temple establishment, a stable economy, but a brilliant creative period. Famous poets like Basho died when he was 50. You know, he could have had in another era another 50 years worth of creative life. So now we've got more opportunities for different kinds of episodes, but we've also got to be given the kind of authorship to do that.
Yeah.
Do you think?
Yeah, turns out you can, on the Japanese example, turns out you can have a really nice creative culture if you don't have any war for 250 years, but fund a military, because then they've got loads of money to spend on art.
Exactly, that's right, yes. Yeah.
And sex, which is what the samurai did. That, you know, they had this huge standing army, but nothing to do with themselves all day, so it turns out they became great patrons of artistic culture. That's probably a lesson for us. Yeah, I think. Yeah, I think this is the idea, right? Like, and why I think thinking about art, the body as an art historical project is a useful way of thinking about things, because we don't do that. We think about bodies as social problems or as individual problems, and actually, I want to think about them as relational problems. You know, they're we're things in the world, the way we look, the clothes we wear, the haircuts we have, the facial hair that we grow, the length we clip on nails, all these kind of things are contingent in a moment in time. And diagnostically, we can look back in history and that can tell us a lot about social attitudes. But sort of as a political project, like understanding that our bodies exist in relation to other bodies, is a kind of key, I think, to starting to think about how we can make situations better so that people don't have, you know, succumb to pathology and struggle with body image and all these kind of things.
So is there a way to have that conversation then, that the body is political, as you say, it carries messages, it sits within a political, social, cultural world, we change over time. Is there a way to have forms of conversation? I mean, you've put on exhibitions, Matt. Helga, you've written about these things and talked about them. Is there a way that we can have different forms of conversation that kind of heal differences and wounds.
What was important for me, so yeah, I did an exhibition at the National Maritime Museum down in Cornwall in 2017, and it went on for a year, and then toured the country for 4 years, and it's now back in Cornwall. I was down in Cornwall last week. We're doing some new work on it to talk about some other issues. We're doing some work on race and tattooing. Because actually, I think talking about how these issues aren't just sicknesses of the modern world, you know, that we've been having conversations about plastic surgery since the 1920s, maybe even earlier. We've been having conversations about gender and gender presentation and gendered and sexed bodies for hundreds of years. We've been having conversations about tattooed bodies for 1,000 years in this country. Showing people that these problems exist kind of structurally rather than locally, I think is probably a useful thing. And I,
or even that they're not problems.
They're or just even that they're not problems,
they're
yeah, exactly.
The way that we, that's
yeah.
the way
yeah,
that we
I think I meant problems
work.
In the academic sense mm. there, you know, questions yeah. that we have about the world. And it was nice, you know, I deliberately structured the exhibition that when you walk in, you start off, actually, the first thing you see is an image of a Pictish warrior, or an imaginary image of a Pictish warrior that was painted at the time of the American encounters at the end of the 15th and in the early 16th century. But it basically says that, oh, you thought that tattooing is this thing that only comes from elsewhere. But actually, 200, 300 years before the Pacific Encounter, antiquarians in Britain were talking about their tattooed ancestors. So instantly, that one moment of going, oh, this is older than I thought it was, the conversation's different to the one I thought it was, you can start shifting a huge amount of complex history about individuals and politics and about, you know, science and all kinds of things are shifted by thinking about things on and through the body, I think. And we got that feedback, you know, by talking about how tattooing was this fashionable practice in London in the 19th century, that King Edward VII and King George V were both tattooed. All of a sudden people are like, oh, actually, I thought I knew who got tattooed and I thought I knew what it meant. And actually, maybe it's more complicated than that. And this kind of scepticism and this kind of individualized relationship to these kind of stories that we're told about modernity, I think is really quite enlightening.
So just the same kind of thing then applies for the assumptions and presumptions that people might make about seeing somebody who's very overweight or very thin, for example, just taking those two aspects of the body, and in a sense the kind of the moral judgments that might follow that. You know, somebody might be trying to become thin and spend an awful lot of effort. Most people fail, as it happens. Mm-hmm. Wonderful for the diet industry. Most people fail. And yet, somebody who might be very thin might have just suffered from cancer. So actually, it's not a good thing at all.
No, exactly.
You know, so the hinterland around mm-hmm. around what you see, I suppose one of the lessons we'd get from this is is use what you see and engage with as a platform for asking further questions about the hinterland.
You want to get away from the shallow, you know, first one glance and that's it, you know, to really explore other sides of it, to explore other things. Where has it come from? Why is it the way it is? What's the historical aspect of it? And can we see these things in other ways? And also sometimes it helps not to talk about something so much, you know, to not put it on the table all the time and to talk about, you know, how we look all the time, but to talk about other things as well. You know, I loved how this year there was a lot more coverage of the Paralympic Games, for example, you know, so it sort of just shows other sides to things that we don't normally see. And I think that really, really helps just to sort of get away from the one singular focus that, you know, that maybe, you know, whatever it is, the tattoos now or the thin body image now and how the media portrays it.
I think that's true as well, because obviously we're a visual species and we mediate the world through images, and you know, increasingly we do that. I think that something like there are more images made every second now or every minute of the, you know, than there ever have been in the whole entire history of the human race up until this point. We're in this extraordinary kind of sphere of images, and that is going to have an effect on how we think about each other's bodies. But you're right about invisibility, right? The kind of bodies that we don't see, either the things on people's bodies that are hidden away. I had a friend who you know, she lost a lot of weight, and someone, oh, congratulations, you've lost so much weight. And she says, no, I've had stomach cancer. Mm-hmm. I'm not well at all.
Mm. This was not intended. Yes.
Yeah, yep. And things about ability, even things about race actually are often invisible in complicated ways, you know, in social context. And I think, like, you're right that the way that we understand ourselves is through mimesis, through empathy, by seeing other people's bodies. And actually, if we're careful about what we think about what we don't see as much as what we do see, we end up with different kind of pictures. What kind of bodies are hidden away? What kind of bodies do we not get to see? What kind of bodies have not been part of the conversation? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to answer your question from a second ago, Jules, about how we start changing conversations, it is about visibility of different kinds of bodies. I think the sort of standard kind of activist sociological position on that would be something like, you know, we don't want to show conventionally attractive people because other people will copy it. I don't think that's how it works. I don't think that's how body image works at all. But I do think that we can certainly pluralize the kind of bodies that are visible in culture to give people different anchor points for the things that they're interested in.
Different spaces to explore as well. Yeah. So let's kind of come to a concluding thought with how this understanding of body and image could or might improve lives. We've heard a lot about identity and kind of authorship, as it were, of the story, the possibilities here. What would you say then are the priorities for younger people coming into a world that we see at the moment? As you said, historically, many of these things are not unique to this particular moment, but a young generation is highly connected, more active and concerned about the world, more inclusive, has more friendship groups, yet is also highly vulnerable because of that connectivity. Yeah. It kind of comes with an edge, as we've seen. What would you say then are the kind of priorities when thinking about body and image? A couple of things at this stage are sort of, okay, all of that's fine. What do we need to think about now? Is it just, as it were, more story, space, diversity, as you've been saying? Or is there something kind of more precise that you'd like to focus on?
I think my sense is that, you know, as a historian of tattoo art, if we believe the big claims of art history, which is that we can tell something about people and places from the art that they made, if that's true for art in churches and, you know, museums, it's definitely true for the images people put on their bodies. And so I think some attention on the kind of images that have been made on people's bodies and are being made gives us a kind of way of talking about different kinds of communities and different kinds of people than we might ordinarily do in kind of popular discourse. So there's kind of visibility. This is the visibility thing that I'm talking about on that front, and a lot of my work is to do with that. But I'm also, I think, interested in empowering individuals to think about this relationship to other people and how their bodies intersect. Because so many of the conversations that we have culturally about bodies are still based on individual conversations. And I think, you know, again, I'm very interested in issues of sex and gender as well. And so many of our conversations about gender identity, for example, don't really understand or don't take into account the kind of corporeal relationship with everybody else. And so I think understanding the relationship of our individual bodies to the structure of all bodies, or the bodies that we see in our everyday lives, can help add some nuance to these conversations, which might help, you know, people who are struggling, people who do have problems, to get the help they need, or for the help that they are offered to be contextualized in different ways. I know that Helga and I have talked about this before in other contexts, but I think that reducing body image to a single problem, to a single individual problem, really is increasingly the issue.
That is the problem, in a sense.
And that's what's been happening, you know, in medical science and psychological science for a long time. But it seems to me that actually thinking about relationally our bodies is a way of breaking the cycle of the conversation. You know, and just to finish this thought, I talk I give often about plastic surgery is, how do you solve the problem, for example, that there is huge amounts wrong with the plastic surgery industry, with its conventionality, with its relationship to capitalism, with its relationship to patriarchy? Undeniably, those things are wrong. But how do you do that without pathologizing the individual people, predominantly the individual women who undergo plastic surgery, and calling them idiots because they don't feel like that and they're not? And the standard kind of activist approaches and the standard political approaches have often been unable to square that circle. And I think the way you square it, or the way that I've squared it at least, is understand that our bodies are visually produced in the culture we live in. So it's unsurprising that people want to have bodies that look like other people's bodies. You solve that question kind of contextually rather than blaming the big evil plastic surgery industry or the idiot individual customers. Like, that's thinking about things systematically and connectedly is the solution. I think that's what we need to do.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the kind of the focus probably ought to shift away from just that sort of appearance side of things and the way that we look at each other in a sort of objectifying way, and ought to go more into how we behave with each other. And, you know, if you think about it, our bodies are kind of our earliest form of communication. You know, it's how we act on the world. Yeah. And therefore, just, you know, moving away from just thinking about yourself in this singular way. And, you know, there's so many ways you can so many things you can do with your body, and so many ways you can use your body for having effects in the world, that I think perhaps, you know, as you said about young people, perhaps, you know, shifting the focus away a little bit away from the body image and a little bit onto what you do with your body and how you relate to other people using your body, right? We all know now how important hugs are, because we haven't had them for so long in the pandemic. And just seeing people now, being at university, seeing the students in person makes me really happy. And I never thought I would feel this way, but it was emotional, actually. So using our bodies in these many other ways that are more about feeling and more about moving and so on, I think is you know, something to never forget.
Fantastic. I think that's a lovely way to end. This kind of opens up a space, and it's kind of interesting, because if we were talking about eating spinach or driving a car, only certain sorts of people would relate to that direct experience. And yet if we talk about the body, well, we've all got one until we die. So this is relevant to all of us, and opening up a kind of conversation which perhaps might lead to a greater sense of togetherness, of belonging, of kind of connection, might be a good thing. So thank you very much indeed, Matt Lodder, Helga Gilmeister. Thank you. That was Louder Than Words. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast. Have a look at the website for more information, and do rate the pod if you can.